My name is Janet Grant. I'm the village philosopher this week, which means that I am trying to provide you with some programming on occasions that challenge you and give you a chance to talk with each other. And if you have issues that you'd particularly like to talk about while you're here this week, pull me aside and let me know. We'll see if we can work it in. Tonight the subject is called Balancing Justice and Mercy, and it's on criminal justice. We're going to use a format that's somewhat different. I have a video that has four parts to it. We probably won't get through all four parts because my guess is conversation will take us into only about two of them. But this tape was developed by the Lutheran Social Service of Illinois and was partially funded by the Walther League. Many of you probably thought the Walther League was long dead. It is not. I am on the board of the Walther League. I'm one of seven people in this country that are on the board. And the Walther League no longer operates as a youth organization, but has some money that it uses and shares in programs. Right now we're sharing in a program with Augsburg College on vocations, a three-year project that they're piloting. We've done a couple of other projects, one of which was this one with Lutheran Social Services in their prison ministry program. If you'd like access to using this film, talk with me sometime while we're here. I can get you in touch with how to make use of it. I think you'll find that it would be a good discussion starter for your congregation or a mission group or something like that. Forums at Holden are a chance for us to come together and talk about issues and to share a variety of opinions. I encourage you to share your opinion even if you feel like you're the only one in the room that has that opinion. And I also invite you to be accepting of differing opinions. I also would ask that you speak for yourself, no one else, since you know what you're thinking the best, and to be brief and to allow as many people to have the opportunity to speak as possible. I will act as a moderator, which means I'll be the timekeeper. My intent is that this session will last an hour. And I will also then act as kind of the facilitator, and if you want to speak, catch my eye somehow, and I'll make sure that you get a chance to do that. So before we begin, I'd like for us just to take a moment and be in quiet prayer together. Gracious God, who gives us our minds to think with and to use and to problem solve and to share ideas, we ask that we may be able to use our voices with clarity and sureness, and our ears with sharpness and wisdom. In your name we pray. Amen. What we'll do is listen to the first 10 minutes or so of the tape. I'll stop it, and then we'll have a brief conversation. It's broken into four topic areas. It'll be real obvious what it's about. So I think we'll just start with that. Hopefully the technology works okay. I'm good at pushing buttons, and that's about it.
Equality and justice are two different terms and can be defined differently in the criminal justice system. And just because, and I agree there have been some gross inequities as far as the application of the penalty, but that just goes to show that the society must do certain things to make that application of that penalty more fair, in a sense that we'll be covering the rich.
Okay, how do we do it? Then what we should do is not have it until we have that system. Because until that time, what you're saying, let us continue being inequitable and being unfair to people and sentencing them to death and letting others go.
I believe capital punishment is something that is necessary for the victim.
I believe the killing is wrong and that the taking of any life is against human nature.
Capital punishment, I don't think, is a great deterrent for crime, but it at least gets rid of that particular individual. You don't have any more difficulty with him.
I have no doubt that we all have very strong convictions about the criminal justice system. It's part of the headlines and television programs of every day and it reaches into our neighborhoods. An issue like the death penalty strikes very close to people of conscience, and maybe especially of Christian conscience. Despite all these strong convictions, however, most of us never really see the inside of a courtroom. So in the minutes ahead, we've tried to arrange an experience in which we'll get a little closer to those kinds of issues. These are people who know, as you and I know, that we live in a society that we like to think of as highly civilized, and yet the world also knows that we are a gun-filled and a crime-filled society, where violence is so common and people feel unsafe, and there are victims of crime and perpetrators of crime who have to be rehabilitated or punished or whatever. Those are hard issues, and we'd like to have some people around who can both represent all of us and also people who bring expertise. We're very fortunate in our moderator, who is Pastor Keith Davis. He really knows both of the two lives we're bringing together here, because he is both a pastor and he is a criminal attorney. In this courtroom with him, we're going to have some other people who are professionals and experts in their involvements with the criminal justice system, and some other people involved in other ways, and some ordinary citizens who will be taking their places in the courtroom more or less as representatives of you and me.
I'm Judge Earl E. Stremore, and I sit in the criminal court of Cook County, have sat here for 16 years. Before that, I was a prosecutor and a defense counsel. I've been involved in and around the criminal judicial system and criminal justice system since 1948.
Kaito Greenlee, Sergeant of Police, Chicago Police Department, 30 years experience.
Deborah J. Gubin, I'm a former assistant public defender. I am now presently in private practice doing criminal defense.
I'm Dean Stone, I'm an attorney in private practice. I'm a former assistant state's attorney and a former assistant public defender in Ramsey County, Minnesota.
Richard Rayle, Sergeant of Police for Naperville, Illinois. I've been a police officer for over 28 years.
I'm Yvonne Del Vahil. I am the mother of a boy on death row.
I'm Stephanie Johnston, and the victim of a purse snatching.
I'm Melinda Westoff, and I live in the suburb of Chicago.
I'm Roland Brands. I'm a retired farmer from the Low County area.
I'm Miriam Wilson, a Benedictine sister, chaplain at the Cook County Department of Corrections, as a victim of a purse snatching.
My name is Alan Sanders. I was convicted for killing a policeman, and I'm now at the governor's state attempting to get a master's degree in counseling.
You were recently the victim of a purse snatching. Can you tell us how you felt when it happened and how you felt since then?
My immediate reaction was anger, rage. I acted pretty quickly in phoning the police. Didn't sleep at all that night. As time went on, I became less filled with a feeling of anger. But since then, I've been more inclined to be suspicious of people on the street if they're walking along. What, you know, what do they want from me? How are they going to hurt me?
Have you done things differently since then? Has it changed your life?
Yes, as a result of the purse snatching, my feelings of being trapped in the particular area where I was living led me to move back home with my parents, so I felt I could move about more freely and not feeling so endangered.
How do you feel knowing that no one was caught, no one's going to pay for this crime, justice is not going to be served?
That doesn't bother me so much as that the criminals themselves, one was a boy, I'd say about 10, and the other one could have been a brother or maybe a friend of about 18, and I just wanted to take them and shake them and say, don't do this, you're setting a precedence for what could be the rest of your life. And if the purse was found up on the roof of a building, that's fine, you know. I'm just grateful I wasn't hurt.
So in some ways, my experience was similar and yet different, because I was hurt. And I just wanted to tell him, stop, wait, please, can I just tell you about that this is no good? And as a result of doing that, I was physically hurt.
So first off, these two women have been the victims of crime.
No one's been caught. No one's been brought to justice. It's unalterably changed their life. How do you react to that, having not been a victim of a crime? Is their fear contagious?
Not really. Because I apparently live in an area, I don't think there's too much purse snatching going on. And I really don't think it has affected my life at all.
What do you think makes your world different than the sisters and Ms. Johnson?
Because probably I have never been a victim.
Well, I live in an area where we have very friendly people. They're all trustworthy. Although I live about 2.5 miles from the Stateville Penitentiary, but people ask me if I'm not afraid living that close to the penitentiary, but this doesn't bother me. Although if I would become a victim, I might have an entirely different view on this thing.
Sister?
Keith, I was wondering if I wanted to return to add to this discussion was the reaction that I found at the jail and when I visited the prison, when I still had stitches that were visible, that there was a very profound reaction from the men that I work with. And one comment that I especially remember is that a man looked at me kind of wistfully and he said, I never saw a victim afterwards.
It creates a society in which Sister and Ms. Johnson have to be fearful of being mistreated.
Wait a second. This is our society. We do have a right here in that broadcasting that fear. And it somewhat then changes what our expectations are as to society as a whole, to the criminal justice system. And what do we expect? So unwittingly, I think we self-perpetrate that fear by one individual being injured and then spreading it, not meaning to, but then going from there.
And this means that we as individuals are going to have to do our each individual little bit toward reducing the possibility that we can be victimized. And we can all do that by being more aware of our surroundings, particularly in the large metropolitan areas. You know,
people are afraid. There is anger in the streets. People don't go out at night. People are worried. People fear the criminal. They fear the criminal element. People fear the fear. How do we deal with that without separating ourselves into two camps, the good and the bad, the good and the evil?
I want to stop there until we go into the next section and open it up for some conversation, reactions to what has been said thus far. Your response. I guess one of the questions I think of right off is just even ask you the same question that they're addressing there, and that is, how are you affected by the possibility of crime or by crime?
Seems so strange to talk about that up here. I've gotten to the habit of leaving my valuables and my money and everything in my room and just walking off with it unlocked. I don't do that at home, but up here it just seems a natural thing to do. And then to talk about paranoia and being afraid of criminals, you have to think for a minute and try to remember what it's been like when you're not here.
I think that fear element is very real. Several years ago, my house was burglarized. And 6 of my 10 neighbors within the month had security systems installed in their homes.
Anytime I walk the streets at night, there's a certain amount of fear.
And you live in a...
Inside. I live in a small town. I work in a community of 17,000 people, so it's relatively safe, but kind of safe.
I had our next door neighbor who was coming home at night about 11 o'clock. She'd taken his mother in the home. And evidently somebody saw her. She turned the corner, and when she got out of her car from the house, they grabbed her purse. And she not long ago for someone who was in a broken shoulder. They got away. But they did get him later. They never got the first thing. But it's taken months for her. She's had physical therapy and she's had such a fear.
Mm-hmm. How about you and other friends?
Well, I've been very wary too, but we've got a code now. When I come home, I'm supposed to haunt the corner twice and let them know, you know, if I'm not any place alone. Mm-hmm.
So you have responded in a way of trying to be smart. Yeah.
Well, Minneapolis has had two people murdered in parking ramps recently, so all the businesses now are having defense programs and so on for the employees.
Have you been a part of one of those? Anybody? Somebody was saying something.
I was just going to say that I'm also from Minneapolis, and I was going to just expand and say fear not only involves a small circle of friends or a neighborhood, but can consume an entire metropolitan area.
I can't resist this. I'm supposed to be the facilitator, but some of you may be familiar with St. Martin's Table in Minneapolis. A small Peace and Justice bookstore, restaurant, and we do forums there. And in October, there's going to be a forum on nonviolent response to neighborhood crime. So if you're interested in that, and the person that's leading it is the director of the Minneapolis Crime Prevention Program. So can't resist an advertisement there. Yeah. I was just going to say,
I think it was 2020 recently that had a presentation on the increased purchase of guns, particularly by women for self-defense, and I think what happened so much is that more and more people carry guns to defend themselves, particularly in Texas. I mean, it's part of mentality. Yeah.
Okay. You think they really make themselves any safer?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I refuse to.
Yeah. We saw businesses don't say that.
Being from the Twin City area too, see, everything was all right. Carry guns, women carry mace. It was too much. Protect yourself. How to be for the victim's protection? And finally, some articles came out. Well, where is the source of the crime? Men attacking women, and the whole, like here was purse snatchers, young boys. Where are all the preventive programs? Where's the other side of it? And that we tend to tighten up on this side and don't get the preventive program. I really resent having to fear, and I refuse to have to be. And they often say, you're the victim the minute you start fearing. Maybe you will become the victim in a way you don't suspect.
What? Yeah, back there.
I think we're developing a culture of haves and have-nots, and the greater that culture divides the people, the higher the crime rate's going to be. So I think that we have to somehow or other do something about the situation where the people feel that they are so deprived that they have to use violence in order to get what they need.
Well, don't you think it's the drug situation that has brought on a lot of the violence? It's not that they don't have, it's just that they need some better habits.
So there's a suggestion that it's a difference of ability to have and drug situation here. Anybody else want to respond? What did you think about the response that the sister made about the prisoner who reacted to her stitches? His response was, I never really saw the victim.
Maybe if more of them did, they wouldn't repeat the crimes. Maybe the first offense, maybe that should be the first thing they do is make them have contact with victims, have them do so much community service work with crime victims and see the other side.
If you were to go ahead.
Okay, that's the concept of the program that I mentioned in the...
Okay, great, thanks.
A victim offender reconciliation program. There are about 35 programs throughout the United States. began primarily in Indiana. I believe there's something happening in Minneapolis. We have three active ones in Oregon. There had been one in the Salem area, but it's not quite functioning. But anyway, the concept is that after a crime, a volunteer mediator brings together the victim and the offender to work out a solution. The mediator meets with the offender privately first and with the victim personally to see whether it's going to be an appropriate case for mediation. And we have been working primarily in property crimes. I am currently working on a negligent homicide case, which has been really fascinating. But anyway, it's the history of it is interesting, and the concept really does exactly what you say. I mean, it gives this offender a chance to have to face up to the person who suffered and to hear that kind of emotional response and to talk about the fears and to talk about what has been destroyed in their own life. And oftentimes, subsequently, then there is a real healing that can happen for the victim because they know that this offender is not going to come again. They have seen a face there. And hopefully, there's not a long enough history to have good statistics on what the results will be. When we talk to criminal justice people, we talk about its final restitution. When we talk in Christian circles, we talk the concept really is reconciliation.
Mm-hmm. So then they were their actual victim, not just a crime victim, but
no, these specific victims.
You're talking about property crimes too.
Primarily.
I wouldn't think that would work very well with violent crimes.
You have great difficulty
getting the victim to agree.
Genesee County, New York. It's done out of the sheriff's department, but they work primarily with rape and negligent homicide cases. They work with professional mediators. As I said, I'm doing a case of negligent homicide now, and I think there is a lot of. I'm also a bereaved parent, and I participate in a grief support group, and I see how these parents who've lost children 5-6 years ago. Are still holding hostility toward the driver who's responsible. And one of my underlying long-term goals is I've talked about with two of them, is the possibility of trying to bring together that driver and the mother of the child who died and allow them to talk face-to-face so that forgiveness can happen, so that healing can happen. And I know the criminal justice program and everybody else says, it works, you know, it's fine for property crime, but don't bring anything else in. I think the concept is there and has value from a Christian point of view for some of the more serious crimes. But again, it's going to be a hard time getting it sold to them.
Yeah. I just think, like rapes, for instance, mm-hmm. you know, when you have so few that are even reported, you know, the victims don't even want to.
Well, when they're reported, that rapist isn't identified.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing about that.
I don't have any literature with me, but if any of you are interested, I'd be happy to send you this information.
I just wanted to ask you a quick question. Have you ever seen any of the criminals experience any kind of a turnaround? Do they gain any insight in this is a real person that I've hurt? Do they gain any compassion?
Or the person who says, who told me, I've never been able to say I'm sorry in my life, a 21-year-old male. And who then broke down and cried and talked about how terribly sorry he was.
So it's helping both sides.
There are times. It doesn't always happen that way, but there are times when that potentially.
I think that's a good point to move on. The next segment is about the people that are involved, so why don't we move into that.
About what caused crime?
I think some people commit crimes intentionally, knowingly, and just go out and they victimize whomever they can. I think other people are sick people who unwittingly get into the criminal justice system as a result of perhaps a mental illness or an emotional instability, probably a larger portion than anyone realizes commit crimes while under the influence of some kind of a drug or an alcoholic drug.
Ms. Cooper, you're a defense lawyer. You deal with families of people charged with criminal offenses. Do you ever see those families evicted?
Most of the time, yes. Not all the time, but most of the time. They are the ones who come in who understand less about the criminal justice system than anyone else. When you have the individual who has been the complaining witness, they have the support of the state's attorney and the police department. But then you have the parents of the defendant. And they come in and they don't understand what's going on, and the only ones who will even talk to them a lot are the defense attorneys. They don't get answers, I think, from prosecutors who they're going to meet first along with the police department as to why their child has been charged or spouse, when they're going to court, where they're supposed to be, and what they can do.
Your son is in prison, is that correct?
That's correct.
And where is he in prison?
He's at Chester, and he's on death row.
How long has he been there?
Since December of 1979.
Been a long time.
Sure has.
How do you maintain a relationship with him?
Well, at first it was a little difficult because I didn't see how I could relate to him, with him being so far away and contact being so limited. But over a period of time, it's become a lot easier. We have regular telephone calls, and I visit as often as I can. And when I was able to put aside the fact that he's there, he is in a prison and he's on death row, and be able to just look at him again as my son with whom I'm trying to relate and carry on a relationship with and have contact with on a regular basis, I was able to, you know, kind of let my guard down and say, hey, you know, you don't have to keep communicating pain and about this whole situation all the time. You can just love it.
Mrs. DeVecchio is a victim. I agree with that. And she should not be held accountable for something that her son did. There's no intent on her part. There's nothing as far as it makes her a quote-unquote bad person morally. It degrades her in any manner.
That's very wrong. You've seen hundreds of people charged with crimes come into your courtroom, hundreds of family members of the victims of crimes. Who's the victim? Who's the real victim?
We all are. And I think it pays us all to look at our system of government in that way. Whenever one of us is hurt in the commission of a crime, we're all hurt. Whenever I have to sentence someone to the penitentiary, if I have to sentence Mrs. DeVecchio's son to death row, we're all the victims, in my judgment.
Mr. Sanders, we've been talking about victims. Heard Judge Strayhorn say that even the person to whom he sentences to jail or prison is a victim in a sense. You've been to jail.
I have.
What did jail do for you?
For me, it was a place where I was raised, more or less. So therefore, it was home. However, I don't think that prisons as they exist today are places for creating a concern within the prisoner for the victims or the so-called victims, because quite often they feel like they are victims too.
But isn't that justice? Isn't that what we want?
It appears that we are asking for one thing when we send people to prison is for revenge. And what our criminal justice system seems to want is something that will assure the society that they're more safer, that we are more safer.
We're told that a majority of the people who go to prison once go back again.
I agree.
Why?
As I said, we find ourselves comfortable in situations where we can encounter. Quite often, persons who are not properly prepared to deal with social issues in the street find it very convenient, very easy to deal with problems in a prison setting because they don't have to think. Someone else does their decision, they conform. And when they're returned to the street, there's the catch-22 that he suddenly has to begin to make decisions for himself, which is almost impossible.
So when the public thinks that when an individual is sentenced, that that sentence is going to bring about, in a magic sense, or in some way, a rehabilitative change in that person's way of looking at life, they are woefully mistaken, and I hate to be the one to tell them that that's not happening. And that what happens is that most of the time, when a person is sentenced to the penitentiary, they're going to come out before they die. And we're going to find that that individual is harder, crueler, more insulated in his cruelty because that cruelty has been institutionalized by what he runs into down in the institution, and they're worse people when they get back out again than they were when we sent them there.
Mr. Stone, you stand in front of judges, and when you were a prosecutor, stood there every day practically, and asked him to send people to the penitentiary. What do we accomplish?
Well, the criminal justice system has a number of goals, and one of them is rehabilitation. Another goal or theory is deterrence, in the sense that if someone is going to be punished, society should know about it, and hopefully it would prevent or stop or inhibit someone from committing a similar offense. And talk about deterrence and being at a fast or quick, effective way of prosecution and arrest. And then we get into the factor besides rehabilitation, and I agree with the judge, it doesn't work.
First question was, who are the victims? Do you agree with the judge?
Yes.
You have responses? Other than yes?
I might be too close to the situation to talk about it. My nephew was found guilty of murder recently. And my sister is a Christian, and she has raised five boys, and he's the only one of the five that has had any deviant behavior. And he was on drugs and supporting a drug habit. He was 23 years old, and he's now in serving time. Life. Was lucky he got life. But I really have to agree with the judge because everybody feels the hurt. It, the ripple effect through, you know, the entire family and the victim's family.
So you kind of understand what Mrs. Delvecchio was saying.
It's really painful.
Responses to that or anything else in this segment?
I think it's public may seem apathetic, but again, it's because they haven't experienced something like this. And it's very hard to get people into the response if they aren't involved for some reason. We can present all of the facts and try to bring this forth, but it is hard. And it can, any of the social issues.
Mm-hmm. What about the man who had been in prison when he says it sort of becomes like home, and they make all your decisions for you and you get used to that? How do people feel about that?
I think we should not teach them to make their own decisions.
Say it again.
Maybe they're part of the program. I have no idea what it's like inside a prison. I don't know what kind of activities they have on there, but maybe part of the program they should have them is helping them to learn how to make those hard decisions. Teach them courses on life on the outside, and not the kind of life they had before, but a life where they do something other than rip people off.
I think realistically, the American penal system has virtually nothing to do with theory about what should happen in prison and what shouldn't happen, and you know what goals you want to accomplish with your prisoners, and it has almost everything to do with money. There isn't enough prison space today to house everyone, and consequently sentencing guidelines are changed to accommodate prison availability and staffing. You know, rehabilitation programs cost a lot of money, and
so what's the solution? Don't have money?
I don't pretend to know, but I know that it's probably more significantly an economic function.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of violence also in your attitudes. And someone talked about apathy. I wish there were more apathy in our state. We're going to have
Oregon.
We're going to have a referendum on a bill that one of our fairly conservative members of the House of Representatives has brought forward, and there's a really redneck attitude of get them and sock them and keep them there for the rest of their lives, and you know, taxpayers pay the bill without any sense of what the cost is to society and what we create for people. Mm-hmm. And again, I think this whole thing of prevention and preparation, we don't have money for drug rehabilitation programs in New York City. We don't give psychiatric counseling to prisoners who are going to be released, and yet what does it cost? $16,000-$18,000 a year to keep somebody in prison.
That's cheap.
I'm sure.
I think it's more than cheap. It's closer to $30,000. I think it's $30,000.
Does that include the capital expenditure for the prison? Mm-hmm.
Well, I can't tell you that, but I think I read just recently that it costs about $30,000 a year to keep a prisoner in prison. And you compare that to in the state of Washington, at least, the average household income is like about $22,000 or $23,000. So it costs more to support somebody in prison than it does to feed an average family.
How much would it cost to send someone to a drug rehabilitation program, you know, for a first offense or whatever? You know, I'm sure it can't be. Tenth the cost of what it costs to keep
them
in prison.
30-day program in California costs about $6,000.
And that's for the 2 months?
30 days.
30 days
in house.
Is it working?
No.
A small percentage.
No, because the judge says, okay, you've got two choices, and neither one of them are very good. One of them is you go to prison, or the other is that you go to the the rehabilitation program. And the person doesn't want to go to either one. Well, I'll take the 30-day stay in the hospital. And he's right back out. And the 32nd day, he's found his old friends again.
How would you feel starting up a relationship with someone who is in prison? Frightened?
Real wary. Frightened? Wary? You're talking about the M2 program?
Say that again?
The M2 program.
I don't know what that is. I just, there's a question I have. Can you
there
tell?
There is a program, again in California, where people that have shown promise that that they truly want to change their ways, that sometime before they are released, they're put in contact with families, and the relationship does grow. That the individual is let known that he is cared for as an individual, and that that there is a support system out there for him.
A system of advocacy is, I think, starting in a number of places. That sounds like one of them. What would people here feel like? How would you feel if you were approached to do that sort of program? Or?
We did have a parolee live with us for several years. It wasn't always a happy time. He had an awful time making good choices after he was out, and he was in again a few times for breaking parole, and each time came out a little worse. But it was worth it for us, although
it
never really changed him. He finally died from, I think, probably drugs and alcohol. He had diabetes for that.
But
it was yet worth it for us somehow.
How?
To feel that we had done what we could with Richard.
Mm-hmm.
He was a part of our family for about 2 years. We lived on a farm and he worked for us. He had been in, I think, 3 years for a $15 check, bad check. And it, you know, that time in there, I know, probably changed his life to go the way it did.
Mm-hmm.
Probably, maybe he would have, anyway, I don't know. But
like the judge says, they come out worse than that.
Right.
What was it like in the decision for your family, that decision process, to have him join your family?
We all agreed. We had two boys, and we all agreed to have Richard with us. And there were some times when he would attempt suicide, and, you know, many different things. We really should have had much more help than we had. I can realize that now. There wasn't really much available. The sheriff,
that's Iowa.
And a parole, his parole officer, but there wasn't much. And it was 15 years ago.
Okay. I'm just wondering how she got in contact with this individual.
He was a grandson of our neighbor.
So you were responding as a neighbor?
As a neighbor.
Anybody else want to respond to that question? How you would feel if you were asked to be an advocate for?
Yeah, silence is an indication that most of us wouldn't do it. I probably would say no, at least at this point. Unless something major came along to change my mind.
I think maybe it would be easier to answer a question of would I be willing to visit a specific prisoner on a regular basis. And I think that's often what the M2 program involves, a regular visitation. I have a number of friends. I haven't been involved in prison visitation, but I have
Presbyterian friend who said, basically Jesus said, you know, visit the sick and the people in prison, and I was in prison and you came into me, and that's a Christian mandate. And so he started attending Lakers Club at the St. Pan. And I think it is a very important ministry, you know, whether it's done in home or whether it's done in prison. I have not done it. I have not felt, in terms of geography or in terms of a few other things, it was my call. But I think it seems to me that it's a ministry that we need to be willing to hear or to listen to.
Does program Prison Fellowship work? Does anybody know anything about that very culture?
I'm on the mailing list, and I'm, you know, I'm really, I tend to be not a conservative evangelical in the way Chuck Colson is, but I'm very much impressed with the stories and so forth they have in their newsletter and the work they're doing. Are any of you involved in that, or any of the rest of you do that thing? I just think it's really worth knowing about, and I'd encourage you to respond if you get a mailing invitation.
The only connection I've had is I have friends who are involved with it, and they think it's wonderful. In fact, friends in my parents' church are visitors and have made friends of a number of people who live in prison, and they consider it more a gift to themselves than a gift they're giving. You know, it's like in everything that we do when we give. I think that initial risk that was hard for them. I also, there's a pretty strong program, I think, in Washington with the Prison Fellowship. And a few years ago, I was aware of some of that being pretty. In fact, some of the people who were part of that came through Holden with some connections with doing a hiking trip and came through here and spent a night, that sort of thing. So those are people. So why don't we look at the next segment? It's on the death penalty, and that will be the last piece we'll look at.
Sentencing you for punishment for what you've done. The judge is not society's avenging angel. And I have never, and I hope I never do, sentence any person before me out of a sense of revenge for society.
The separation from society is the punishment. That is the punishment. We are saying, you can't function here, you can't abide by our rules and regulations, you need to be over here somewhere else. And that is the punishment, the separation.
Well, the best thing is to give the person the desire to live in peace and dignity with a fellow human being and not send them to a penitentiary. That's what society has to do. Let's put it this way. There is a certain percentage of people who are not going to do right, will not live in peace and dignity except when forced to by a policeman being present or by a court or something. Then we've got to take those people out of society where they don't come back anymore. Kill them or put them in for life or whatever. But society has to make the decision by determining what they want the law to be.
Sergeant, 34 states, the punishment which Judge Strayhorn just mentioned, killing him, is legal. Capital punishment. Does capital punishment stop crime?
I really don't think so, my own personal belief. I think that most crimes that capital punishment are for are probably heat of passion, heat of anger, and are done. The person who does it on a plan, well thought out, he may think about it before he does it. But the rest of them will probably do it on a spontaneous and never think about the chance of having death by electric chair.
I'd like to equate it with a toothache. If you get rid of that one, you won't have any difficulty with it again. Doesn't mean you won't have trouble with one of the other 31 that are left. But capital punishment, I don't think is a great deterrent for crime, but it at least gets rid of that particular individual. You don't have any more difficulty with him.
Why do we have capital punishment?
Well, I think for revenge. It's how you're brought up from your childhood days.
Sister, what do you want Judge Strayhorn to do in your name?
I believe the killing is wrong, and that the taking of any life is against human nature, and that we really do not have the right to take life. And we as citizens, are we willing to execute a person when that moment comes, because it's in our name that it's done? And I think as members of churches, we have a moral question that's raised, and that we need to really look at what our criminal justice system is doing in the various areas that have already been touched on in this discussion, and especially in capital punishment.
I believe capital punishment is something that is necessary for the victim. It is something that is necessary because to do anything less than that dehumanizes the victim of a murderer. The murderer who did a conscious, intentional action of taking another person's life. The death penalty can be called a great equalizer.
If we eliminate one person, we certainly don't help the victim any. The victim will never come back. The victim's family is not in any way healed or reconciled by the death of another person.
Let me ask this question. It's generally assumed that you or I don't have a right to kill. Does society have that right?
Yes, it does. Historically, it has that right. From the day one on of organizational institutions, governmental institutions, from the Bible itself, we can quote chapters and verses in the Old Testament.
The Bible says that there should be no judgment done in unrighteousness, and there is not to be any inequity in any kind of judgment that makes it unrighteous. The death penalty cannot be applied according to biblical edicts, nor according to legal edicts, on that principle. Because there are too many inequities, not all people who commit the same crimes are found guilty of and given the same kind of punishment.
I think that when we get on biblical grounds, that we're on the weakest ground that we have to argue it. I would prefer to argue it on the basis that you have taken, that it is not applied evenly and justly across the board. Now, on that grounds, we have most solid grounds to stand on, and no one, not even the harshest person, and the person that agrees that the capital punishment ought to be imposed can deny that. And that's the strongest reason why we shouldn't have it, because it isn't applied fairly and evenly across the board.
I don't feel that most people that receive it because of what they did, but because of who they are.
The poor people will get the punishment, and the wealthy can a lot of times buy their way out of it.
Is that fair?
No.
It's not fair, I agree completely.
But that's not a call for abolition of the death penalty in itself. It's a call for making the system work better and receive for those people who have committed the horrible offense of murder, receive their just punishment of death. Period.
Then what we should do is not have it until we have that system. Because until that time, what you're saying, let us continue being inequitable and being unfair to people and sentencing them to death and letting others go. And so we can keep.
No, we're going back to our process of what you talked about too is before, and what you said is the evolving criminal justice system, and that's what we have. We react. We react to what's going on in the courtroom, what's going on in the streets, what's going on with the sentencing.
Life until you know it's going to be fair, and you're not going to be able to give somebody a second chance.
Well, some people don't deserve a second
and
chance.
And who are you to make that decision that they're not there to deserve a second chance if you weren't fair in meeting out the punishment in the first place? Now, once you execute, you can't go back and look back and say, wait a second, we made a mistake, what can we do to correct it? If we hurry up and take life, we're taking that decision from ourselves and reevaluating facts, and we're then allowing sometimes, and I think this is what's happening in society, to have fear control it and say, let's push us along, this person has taken another life, so we must take their life. We are a system that always reevaluates. And if you have the death penalty, if you take a life, you are no longer allowing yourself the ability to reevaluate.
Does society have the right to kill?
What'd you say?
Does society have the right to kill? Making a difference in particular greater numbers. I mean, does a mob of 10,000 have more of a right to kill someone than I as an individual? Or even a million? I mean, I don't see that the numbers should make any difference.
That's an issue that I have always struggled with for a long time. In fact, it was interesting. I checked out a tape today on capital punishment here in the building. I didn't get any inclusive evidence out of that either. But I've always struggled with that. What do you do with people who openly and notoriously take a life of somebody else? Do we have the right to snuff out a life? That's really a big decision to make, but what do you do with them?
Seems a lot of the decisions are being made because of money, because it's cheaper to just fry them than to maintain them in prison for 30 years or however long that they live. And that shouldn't be the reason that we decide to kill someone or not to kill them, because it's more costly to keep them alive. Did you understand?
No, not yet.
Go ahead.
Well, let's get the military involved in this. Does a soldier have the right to kill? You get somebody shooting at you, you want to shoot back.
Okay.
And you're being told by society to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You can't divorce that from just prison terms. But circumstantial evidence is one thing to kill somebody on that. But if there's no doubts there that they got the right person.
Society does kill.
Situation, that's a different story.
You're saying society sanctions killing in that way?
But you're eliminating the military. considerations.
So what you're saying is that through military, our society is saying it's okay.
Society is putting you in the firing line.
Anybody want to respond? Hot topics?
I think of somebody like John Gacy in Chicago who killed all those children, all those boys, and he's still alive. You know, I get real mixed feelings. Should we then continue to support him all these years? It's costing us a fortune when he was guilty of so much. Mm-hmm. And is there any sense of, I mean, is there any chance of rehabilitation of that man? Mm-hmm. I don't know where I am on it.
Yeah.
I mean, my immediate anger is to get rid of him. You know, we don't want him around when he did so much bad.
Mm-hmm. One man said we have punishment for revenge, and the judge says I never want to be used
right.
for revenge.